Okay, yeah, so I am talking about stellar pollution. And just to sort of set the scale to from the beginning, that we're talking about pollution on the order of Earth masses of material. So, you know, that's worse than a bad day in Los Angeles, if you can believe that. But I don't know if you've been following the news. I guess the EPA keeps relaxing its standards, so, you know, we may get there yet. So this is something that I'm working on right now, actually, with Doug. So this is kind of work in progress. And the basic idea, of course, is that it's now pretty firmly established, I would say, that stars with planets have higher metallicities than stars in which we don't see planets. And of course, the fundamental question there is, does high metallicity cause planet formation, or is it an effect of planet formation? And our idea here was, well, if you have planets forming around a star, it's difficult to see how there wouldn't be some amount of pollution. And so we wanted to try to constrain a little bit just how much pollution you might expect. And so here's a picture from paper by Norm et al. In 2001, which shows some stellar models for different mass stars. And you can see that the basic idea is that the less massive a star is, the longer it takes to get to the zero-age main sequence. What we've plotted here is the convective envelope mass. Now, the convective envelope is where we expect to see the signature of accretion. So if you have a deep convective envelope, you dump material into it, nothing much happens. You're not going to be able to see anything. On the other hand, if you pollute, if you drop material onto a star that has a thin, low-mass convective envelope, you have some chance of seeing a signature of this. So the general idea, you know, you can see from looking at this, is the more massive a star is, the lower mass the envelope, the better a chance you have of maybe detecting some accretion. Also, not only because the envelope has a low mass, these masses are actually not quite what actually happens, but also because the envelope contracts earlier or becomes small earlier.
How do you know that pollution is confined to the envelope?
Well, it's sort of an assumption. I mean, it's a good assumption if you have a relatively massive envelope. Of course, the stars where we expect to see the most, F stars with a very, very thin envelope or almost no envelope at all, that is sort of the place where you may start questioning that assumption, because if it's that thin, maybe the material punches right through. I mean, this is one assumption that is being made that, you know, that sort of underlies all of this, that we are actually, that the material is actually staying in the envelope.
Is it little stuff coming in?
Or whole planets? Well, what we're looking at here is larger stuff coming in. So this is this is not tiny little planetesimals coming in. This is basically after larger protoplanets have formed in the inner solar system and start disturbing each other, and we're looking at how many of those might end up falling into the star. Yeah, yeah, things like that. So I mean, yeah, that's one issue. You could envision those actually punching through. Call it dredged. Perhaps. Yeah. This is okay. This is actually exactly the next point. I mean, maybe the sort of initially the most natural place to look for pollution is early on when you have a gas disk and you presume that things are accreting, migrating inwards rapidly. But yeah, as you're alluding to, you also have gas that's coming in at the same time. So if you sort of look at the big picture of things, I mean, you're accreting solids, you're accreting gas. You can sort of step back and ask, well, how much of this gas do you actually lose? I mean, how much of the gas is actually not accreted onto the star? I don't know, maybe 30% are numbers that you hear. So if you, yeah. Yeah, or it's just photoevaporated off. I mean, it's sort of a rough guess, but basically, whatever stuff migrates all the way into the star is going to be diluted by a lot of gas at the point, and therefore the metallicity enhancement that you expect during that phase is not terribly high. And so that's why what we're really focusing on is after the gas is gone, and anything that gets dropped onto the star at that point is going to be presumably rocky. And so in this case, even in things that are less than 1.2 solar masses, you may have some chance of seeing a signature. And so this is so this is sort of the point where the simulations, from which the simulations start. And so a little bit of a motivation for the initial conditions that we use. Now in the terrestrial region, growth of planets, we think, proceeds in three stages. Initially, things grow by runaway growth. You have a bunch of small planetesimals, a couple of bodies detach themselves from the mass spectrum and grow much quicker. Then we have the stage which Kukubo and Ida have called oligarchic growth, and have done a lot of work on this. And in this stage, basically, runaway growth slows down because the largest bodies become big enough to start sort of stirring the soup around themselves, and it becomes more of a self-regulating process, and the accretion rates become slower, and the tendency is for comparable mass bodies to form. And that keeps going until basically all of the planetesimals have been swept up. And now you can make estimates of how fast this happens and how big of a protoplanet you get at different places in the protoplanetary disk. And so these are some estimates here: after 5 million years, after 10 million years. This is an Earth mass up there. And the basic idea here is that it seems that by the time the gas goes away, you've pretty much completed the sweep up of planetesimals, or largely completed the sweep up of planetesimals. So basically, oligarchic growth has probably finished throughout most of the terrestrial planet region by the time the gas goes away, by the time we get to the stage that we're looking at. In addition to that, there's also this work by Kominami and Ida, in which they, I should step back first and say a little bit about the final stage. The final stage is when you have these oligarchic growth end products, which then gradually over longer time scales, sort of 10 to the 8 year time scales, perturb each other onto crossing orbits and collide with each other. And after that is done, we think we get, you know, a solar system like we have, and presumably as happens in other stars. So we are looking at the third stage. And so what Kominami and Ida did is they showed that while there is still gas present, the third stage is probably delayed. The onset of the third stage is probably triggered by the removal of the gas, simply because while there is still gas there, even a very small amount of gas will damp the eccentricities of these protoplanets, not so much by aerodynamic drag, but actually by tidal interactions, the eccentricity damping that accompanies type 1 interactions. And that is enough to actually prevent things from crossing. So you probably have to wait until the gas has been almost completely cleared away before all of this rattling around of planetary embryos starts. And so that's why we chose initial conditions that look like this. Here's an example. We just estimated what these final oligarchic growth end product embryos will look like and what spacing they will have. We sort of estimated a 10 Hill radius spacing and put down a bunch of these bodies between a tenth of an AU and 2 AU, put in a Jupiter and a Saturn. So we're assuming a planetary system with an architecture like our own. So this, in this case, this is a minimum mass disk, sort of reference to the standard minimum mass Hayashi nebula. And so we tried this with a minimum mass disk and up to 10 times minimum mass disk. And then we evolved this system for up to 3 by 10 to the 8 years. And at the same time, we track how much mass crosses the inner boundary of the simulation, which in this case is at a tenth of an AU. So that's sort of the idea, is that sort of gives you an upper limit on how much mass could end up dumped onto the star. And here's an example of how one of these simulations turned out. So what's being plotted here is the semi-major axes of all of the embryos. These are the black lines here. Up there you see the Jupiter and Saturn analog. And the yellow, I don't know how, it doesn't show up that great, but the yellow is the peri and apo distance of each of these. So the further apart peri and apo are, the bigger the eccentricity. And every time two of these bodies run into each other, they are assumed to stick. We're assuming perfect collision. So we plot a little blue dot every time a pair of them accrete. Every time one of them crosses the inner boundary, we have a red dot. And so we run a bunch of these for different disk masses. And so we can combine all of these results together and plot the cumulative mass loss as a function of time. And we get something that looks like this. So this is for a minimum mass disk, all the way up to 10 times minimum mass. And so as you expect, of course, the more massive of a disk you have, the more material is going to end up crossing your inner boundary and we assume polluting the star. But also a more massive disk will evolve quicker. And the time scale for everything to finish happening will be shorter. So we can see a minimum mass disk is going to keep going until past 10 to the 8 years. It's going to keep going, going to keep dumping material onto the star. 10 times minimum mass is going to stop after just about a million years. Yeah? Well, what's happening, I mean, if those red dots up there, I mean, it indicates something that has its semi-major axis up there at the time that it gets ejected. So, I mean, what's actually happening, and you can't see it here because the output time step is too big, but just before that happens, of course, the eccentricity gets very big, and so the yellow line would go all the way down here. But what's happened, basically, is that this thing has had a close encounter with Jupiter. So there's a couple of these happening up there, so that's how Jupiter is picking up a little bit of extra eccentricity. But, I mean, that's something you would expect to have happen.
But it's not very much. I mean,
it's not very much,
spacing
no.
Of the dots, it's
yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, that's why it's changing. The yellow gets squashed together. All of the mass that we're tracking here is just mass that's lost inward. Some of it is ejected, but we're not adding that. I mean, we're just interested in the stuff that actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you look at how much was ejected slash was accreted inside point one AU or whatever?
For the inner edge, no, we haven't done that yet. But again, the idea is to get sort of an upper limit. You know, anything that crosses that boundary, you go, well, you know, that could conceivably have hit the star, and no, that's the idea there.
You're assuming anything beyond 2 AU is more likely to be ejected than possibly.
Well, we're not. I mean, anything beyond 2 AU can sort of do whatever it does, and it's free to interact with Jupiter, you know, Jupiter and Saturn. Oh, okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Well, the idea there is, again, we're sort of, you know, very focused on the idea of the, you know, of our solar system. We're sort of using that as our starting point. And in our solar system, what we expect to have happen is that this region was as Makiko can tell us, was swept by secular resonances and probably cleared out early on. And you know, if this is what happened, if this region was cleared out during the dispersal of the gas, and sort of by definition, you know, once we start the clock on these simulations, that region is not going to have a lot of gas in it. Also, if you look back to the to these estimates from oligarchic growth. at least after 5 million years, the growth may not have actually completed into there. So you may have a situation where all of that region is just small bodies, and which I guess you kind of have to have in order for this clearing to work. And the alternative explanation, I think, that the John Chambers has a model where you actually have all of the material in the asteroid belt, a lot, most of it getting swept up into planets, but then these planets are unstable on some time scale. So that is, I mean, that material could have conceivably also ended up in the star. But in this version, we're sort of just looking at the stuff directly from the terrestrial region, and for the time being, we're not worrying about the stuff out there. Well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, that's the assumption that's going into here, that you can drop a large body into the star, and it'll break up and it'll get mixed into the envelope. But I mean, this is one of the caveats in all of this. You know, if that is not true, then you know maybe the reason we don't see pollution in F stars is because their envelope is so thin that this stuff just falls right through. So that's sort of one way out.
How does one distinguish?
So what's the limiting mass then?
I don't know the answer. I don't know the result. Okay. The explorer, you know, what mass would and velocity would punch through the floor, and how much of that mass would dissolve and back on the floor.
But I would have thought that it would take several. You know, you're not like they could want to go.
Yeah,
those past capacities. And you're going to disrupt the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what.
I always wondered why they were
doing this calculation. Yeah, it would seem to me it would be hard to get it in there intact, and then. But, yeah.
Well, when I asked him this, he said, "Well, we don't know.
We don't know why they did these calculations."
No, he doesn't know how it's going to approach. Right? We don't know how it's going to approach.
But is that really true, Norm? Because you need some time for the investment.
Well, no, that's the question. So how is it going to approach as a goat comes in? And it's that big of a body. It's one of the biggest bodies in the thing. And it's going to be going in a random walk via scouting up a fairly small body.
That was a paper.
Right, so the payoff is going to come down fairly slowly.
There's a paper not long ago that said you couldn't believe that Jupiter would just sink in.
There were several different calculations, and I think the most believable one is that, in fact, Jupiter would disrupt you. But the Earth, you could imagine, is a little tougher than a Jupiter.
And not that big an extent.
It's close to the surface, yeah. I mean, the density of the Earth is 5 or whatever. And the star is 1, so it's right near the surface, yeah.
There may be secular resonances, too, which are driving the perigam. You know, that's what often happens in comets, at least.
You mean with the giant planet?
Yeah, from the giant, resonances from the giant planets can drive objects in this region down to very eccentric orbits.
But on timescales which are longer than the orbital ones, yeah.
Yes,
which means it'll come in slowly again and it'll be subject to this disruption over time. So
I don't know what the changes in eccentricity from one period to the next. Is it enough to cause me to change the periapsis by a stellar radius?
That's interesting.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, assuming that this is actually going to be recorded in the envelope, having this hanging over it, so the question then is how much of this cumulative mass that we are plotting here is actually going to be recorded in the envelope? Now, it's going to be whatever the total amount of mass we drop in there is minus whatever the mass is at the time that the envelope first gets small. And we have to remember, though, that we're starting the clock on these simulations at the time where the gas dissipates, so we sort of have to add that extra amount of time, which will take to be 10 million years. We'll take it sort of on the large side of the gas disk lifetime, because that will give us more pollution, and we're sort of trying to get an idea of more of an upper limit on the amount of pollution that we might get. And so we can do that. So, I mean, just as an example, for instance, assuming a solar-type star, which will have its convective envelope contract down, which will reach the zero-age main sequence after maybe a little bit more than 20 million years. So add on, say, another 10 million years for the gas to go away. So we're at 10 million years. So it'll be whatever mass is between here and here. So it's going to be sort of order an Earth mass that we drop in this model. On the other hand, if we look at, this is for a minimum mass disk, if we look at a 10 times minimum mass disk, it's finished doing its thing after a couple of million years, so we're not going to see anything. So it's sort of, you have this sort of counterintuitive result that a more massive disk could actually cause less pollution.
Why do you assume it's going to get more pollution?
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that by the time you get to here, by the time the pollution has finished, well, polluting, at that time you still haven't reached the main sequence, so the convective envelope is still big. So whatever pollution you drop in there is lost without a trace.
How does one distinguish when you look at a star and whether that metallicity is due to the primary composition of the star as a whole and permeates quality of use zone, or is pollution down by a whole?
I guess the answer is no, we don't really know.
Always come up with a good one.
Yeah.
The sun,
astroseismology. Yeah, but not very good.
But they're starting to get.
No, they're not.
They're kind of shaky.
The one that's from Mexico that you can do is from the stone. That gives you much better.
From what? Neutrinos.
That's. Even that's of order in Earth mass, so you could hide easily an extra Earth mass of metals and you wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
Astroseismology is not
the problem. But it's been the wrong wavelength mechanism. You're saying it's more magnetic core on the outside. But you can't do it.
No,
the astroseismology.
Oh, well, that's just because of the capacity wrong.
Oops. Yes, so.
Yes, we should not believe in six predictions. In solar type stars, you can believe in them really.
The transit.
Sorry.
None
of the solar type stars, you can't believe any of them. But there are some very low mass, very low metallicity stars, which have nothing to do with planets. But you can do that, but it's even there.
So what we've done here then is we've taken the idea from the previous plot, how much mass gets, when does the mass start getting recorded, when does it stop polluting, and also how deep is the convective, how massive is the convective envelope, and constructed some estimates of the change in metallicity as a function of disk mass. So the top panel, these are just two different scales. So the top panel, you can see that going up to 1.2 solar masses, which is just on the bottom end of the so-called lithium dip, where the trend in envelope masses is going to reverse for a while. Going up to there, you get metallicity changes of less than 0.02, and I mean that's the maximum because, again, as I was explaining before, you can make the disk mass bigger and bigger, but at some point you're going to speed up the evolution. You're going to speed up how fast the stuff gets dropped, and then that means the total pollution you're going to be left with is in fact going to be less than for a less massive disk. So, for instance, for an Earth mass disk, if it's more than about 7 times minimum mass in that model, you don't record anything. Okay, so not more than 0.02 from. In for up to 1.2 solar masses. Now, if you go to the other side of the lithium dip to stars that are more massive than about 1.5 solar masses, Well, in that case, by the time the gas goes away and by the time we're starting the clock on our simulations, well, the envelope has already contracted down. The envelope is already very thin, so you're going to record everything that happens. And so now we just have a monotonic increase of pollution with disk mass, as you would intuitively expect. So that's really the place where you have a chance of seeing something. And so, of course, Norm has done work on trying to find trends of metallicity with stellar mass. And other people have too. And I guess is it fair to say the results are sort of a little bit? I mean, some people say yes, some people say no.
They're definitely mixed.
They're definitely mixed. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess you guys were finding up to maybe anywhere between half an Earth mass to five Earth masses of iron could have. I mean, this is iron. This is not the total mass. Could have been dumped into stars just from a survey of stars. And I guess Deborah is sort of saying no. You know, they look at a whole bunch. Ooh, feedback. They're looking at a bunch of stars and they're not seeing any trend. There's the Pinsonneau et al. Paper. I think they were using envelopes that were not massive enough. I mean, they were using that first picture that I was showing there. And I think they were actually using those envelope masses, which are, I think, too low.
What I would say is that Pinsonneau et al. Didn't really look at any data, and what they did was they used extremely thin envelopes and dumped in huge amounts of
It wouldn't explain that like 30 Earth masses of iron or something.
Planet-bearing stars wasn't seen there, which is true, but it's sort of irrelevant. Mm-hmm. There was stuff I haven't actually seen, but I'm surprised she didn't see much because their sample has a B minus B color selection.
Mm-hmm.
And so their stars are selected to be more and more metal rich as you go to higher and higher temperatures.
Okay.
I've seen talks on her results. She does try to account for this B minus B.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's hard at the point, right? Because you basically can't see any metal core massive stars.
Yeah.
There's not a sample. So it's kind of hard to correct for that.
There's that
and
extra.
I even took what they give you. It looks like there's a whopping trend.
Right.
With stellar mass.
But then again, you know, the Fisher result is the only sort of self-consistent analysis of this. Everything
it's
else
the only one
is
where you know what the selection effects
are. Right. Everything else is pulling together two different samples that are at different selection criteria.
Yeah.
You can try to account for this, but it's just.
Which brings us to the next point, which, I mean, the way that you can eliminate this, or you can try to eliminate this, spread of age problem, which, you know, trend of metallicities with age and with mass, is to look at clusters where presumably everything is of the same age and started from a cloud with the same metallicity. And then simply look at the spread in metallicities and get some idea of, you know, how much, take the spread in metallicities to be some indication of the amount of pollution that may have happened and get upper limits on how much you might have polluted. And so this has been done for the Pleiades, but again, in this case, only for solar type stars, at least that I'm aware of. So they get a dispersion in metallicity of 0.02. And if we go back to the previous, I mean, that doesn't really tell us very much because for solar-type stars, that's sort of the upper limit anyways. I mean, it's consistent, but it doesn't really give us a constraint because that's just as much as we can get anyway. For the Hyades, it has also been done, and those samples did include F-stars, and they found dispersions of around 0.03, up to 0.03. I mean, there's some other ones that say up to 0.1, but I think I'm not sure which of these is. Well, let's say 0.03 for the time being. So, whoops. Now, if we look at this curve, 0.03 is, you know, it's consistent with a minimum mass disk. Now, keeping in mind that these are upper limits in pollution that we're obtaining from our simulations, still you get the idea that if you go very, very much above minimum mass, then maybe you start running into a problem. So what this sort of very tentatively seems to be telling us is that from F stars at least, it doesn't seem like the disks, at least in the terrestrial region, are enormously massive. Otherwise, we would be seeing larger dispersions in these clusters. Not, I mean, all of this can happen with just terrestrial planets. Of course.
No, but the injection, I guess it depends on how significant.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. For our example, we picked something that looks like the solar system. I mean, the basic idea that you can pollute the star with stuff from the terrestrial region is going to also work if you don't have a giant planet there. The time scale is going to be somewhat longer. But of course, the problem is, I think when you get to a very massive disk, it's hard to, it's maybe not that plausible that you don't have a giant planet in there.
But I think that's a good point, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Have you tried it without Jupiter and Saturn? One would think, because the escape velocity from the surface of even the Earth is much less than the circular velocity, it's hard to scatter things into the sun without sort of resonances or
right.
strong perturbations.
It's, we've done that. I mean, it the same thing basically happens. It happens over a longer time scale. And especially the initial, one thing that definitely takes longer is the initial orbital crossing. Before the time for the orbits to initially start crossing takes longer. You don't have this extra perturbation from Jupiter that is sort of shaking things up.
So that helps because it happens later when the star maybe thinner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So actually, if you don't have a giant planet, if you suppose you have a massive protoplanetary disk, but you don't have a giant planet in it, then you could actually get more pollution because you get a lot of pollution, but you get it more spread out.
Well, actually, I guess I'm thinking more in the direction of actually putting something more like the observed population of this whole planet. That you probably don't really even have, in many cases, you probably don't even have a stable terrestrial.
That's, yeah, I mean, that's, I would say, I mean, you'd have to try it out. I mean, there would, there may be other things at work there, of course, but in the most naive picture of this, I mean, if you imagine taking giant planets and plopping them down at 1 AU or less, yeah, you don't have a stable terrestrial region, or whatever terrestrial region you do have is probably going to evolve a lot faster. So in that sense, you actually expect close-in giant planets to give you a lower amount of pollution. And well, I mean, they got there while the gas. Sure. Yeah, but which is has an upper limit of like 10 million years. I mean, presumably they didn't move that much after the gas went away. I mean, so that's sort of when we start the clock, anyway.
Assuming you get pollution, what's the time scale for the pollution to settle out?
To
settle out with the convective.
Well, the idea is that it stays there. I mean, that the convective zone is sufficiently disconnected from, I mean, that it's convective, the rest is not convective. So whatever gets into the convective zone stays in the convective zone.
What do you expect in sort of over time for everything to not be completely
if,
coupled to the convection would start to settle out of the convective zone?
If it happens, it would be a very small effect, I think.
Well, actually, it's a relevant question.
Means that's.
And I didn't realize this at the time, but basically it's like salt finger instability in ocean.
Convective overshoot.
It's not convective overshoot, no, it's just the fact that the thermal time scale is very short, whereas the molecular diffusive or even the turbulent diffusive length of time is much longer. So if you have the bottom of the convection zone, because of the convective overshoot, you put some material that has a high metallicity in it. It'll heat up because it'll absorb photons from the surrounding. So it'll have roughly the same temperature as the surrounding, but it'll still be higher molecular weight. So it'll end up, even though it's convectively stable, by the Newton criterion, because of the difference in the time scales, it'll actually end up being, these things will then punch down into the radiative zone. It turns out you can drain the metal down in a hurry. So
how much of a hurry?
1,000 years.
So why would we not see metal, why do stars have any metallicity?
It's a great, so as long as they're uniform, it's okay.
But if you have a heavy icy, you have higher mean molecular wave above and a lower one below, then it's unsafe.
Well, I do
like
more stuff.
Typically, they don't.
Some
that are treated. Treating ones. And the ones that aren't treated, maybe three are treated. Well, they treat them.
I didn't think that was universally accepted.
There's some also wind loss that can somehow be.
For white girls. But if you just had a mixed hydrogen envelope on top of a white core, the metals drop out there. But that's from a totally different process. That's just the molecular, individual atoms going down.
Also, there's one on one on the helium.
Is that something
you're
down? In neutron
stars? Yeah, in helium.
There's no hydrogen. Right, so you just see it. Now, the gravity there is so strong, it just drops out there, but for very different reasons. So the upshot is, this is coming out of paper by Sofal, but I should realize it just looked like a star. But in fact, the time scale to get out of the convection zone is very short. So in fact, except at very low metallicity gradients, so maybe like the ones you're talking about, you might still,
So that would mean that actually for something like an F star where you have a very thin envelope, does the thinness of the envelope probably also doesn't help you?
Something where the metallicity doubled, for example, it would just drain out. There's no question in my mind. Now these very low metallicities may be.
Right.
What about lithium? When lithium's being burned in the center,
and that makes
you.
Well, as long as the mean molecular weight's the same above and below, which it is, because the lithium doesn't account for any molecular weight. I mean, the difference in mass between gas and solid lithium and mobile lithium is absolutely tiny in the molecular weight here. This is actually changing the bulk molecular weight. Or just burn out the lithium, the lithium's a tiny fraction.
Well, the pump's got so fast, you just see the
lithium. No, the instability is triggered when there's a certain gradient pushing it. So if the gradient is tiny, it doesn't do anything. And that's if you just burn the lithium, it doesn't change the
molecule.
Well, it's got to be, there's a competition between two time scales. And so the gradient has to be big enough to overcome that competition.
So we're basically stuck trying to look for relatively small, modest changes in the metallicity. The amazing levitating metals. Okay. Anyway, so just to end on a sort of more, what does this tell us about the architecture of terrestrial planetary systems? So insofar as one can draw any conclusions from this about disk masses, for a system that that has a minimum mass disk in the terrestrial region, we know, this is a simulation that we did here. This is actually one of the same simulations I showed before, showing the end state at after a few 10 to the 8 years. And this is, you know, very similar to the sort of results that John Chambers gets. You get a couple of bodies left in the terrestrial region, and they have, you know, masses that are sort of comparable to the Earth and Venus, and, you know, you have trouble making things as small as Mars, also in this case, but again, that may be because you're not putting in small enough things initially. Maybe you have also some, you know, things beyond 2AU that haven't quite finished oligarchic growth. Okay, so but generally that looks about right. I mean, there's always the eccentricity problem. Now, if you pump things up to 5 times minimum mass, we start seeing systems that don't look all that similar to our own. We start getting bodies that are almost up to 10 Earth masses. So, you know, the isolation mass the isolation mass goes as the surface density to the 3/2. So you can get quite a bit of increase in the masses.
So did this actually bring to this using the first mechanism?
This is, yeah, I mean, this is all of this other stuff is happening at the same time. Material is falling onto the star. This is what's left in the very end. This is what's left after the pollution is stopped and after basically the orbits are not crossing each other anymore and the system is relatively stable. Similar time scale, tends to be a little bit longer. Usually the pollution stops before the system stops evolving. But yes, similar time scale. And so finally, 10 times minimum mass gives us, it's a pretty hefty 20 Earth mass body there, and you know, it's like 7 or 8 Earth masses in there. So, you know, insofar as one can draw any conclusions about from all of this pollution business, you know, that would imply that maybe these systems are not so common, which, you know, might not be great news for TPF, for instance. You know, if they keep wanting to revise the definition of a terrestrial planet up to many Earth masses, then, you know, it would be good if there were systems like this. But
it's not just bad news for TPF, it's bad news for California at the same time.
Sure. And, okay, let's, I don't think I have any more slides.
Well, not bad news. I mean, it depends on your finding. That's an interesting result.
It's interesting in a more abstract sense.
And if they're more rare, in order to have a significant role, then we don't need to have a more powerful system.
So in other words, you should spend more money.
Yeah.
The threshold where it's great,
I don't disagree. If you really want to find the answer, you want it anyway.
The threshold where your statistics are getting pretty dicey for Sim, Kepler, and Kepler is, you know, a few Earth masses. For Kepler, it's the same. It could be better closer. You know, if there really aren't very many 10 Earth mass things,
there are plenty of high energy accelerators around that won't discover the Higgs, things like that.
Okay, well, that's it.